Hi everyone, just before we get started, I wanted to just quickly come and tell you about the BSPHN 2024 conference, which is titled Using Behavioural Science to Address Shared Challenges for Prevention. We've just got word that it's gone live, so go and check it out now. It is on Tuesday the 20th of February in 2024 at Liverpool John Moores University. Speakers include Sir Michael Marmot, Ashley Gold, Professor Matt Ashton and Sue Cumming, all of whom are great speakers. So I just wanted to come on quickly at the very beginning of the show before we get going to let you know that that is going on and you should go and book now. Hi, and welcome to the Real World Behavioural Science podcast, where we look at how behavioural and social sciences are being used in the real world to help change the public's health for good. My name's Stu King, and I'm here with Dr. Tiago Motella with another great show for you. Tiago, how are you?
Hi, Stu. I'm very good. The sun is shining, birds are singing, had a lovely weekend, so today's a great day, I think. How about you?
A nice weekend at Harry Potter World.
It was full of magic and wonders.
Oh,
yes,
nice.
It was lovely.
I'm good. I'm also good. Thank you very much. Well, I tell you what, I'm excited about today's show. We must have rescheduled this show six times. We tried to do it in person loads of times, but thank you TFL and the strikes. We have not done this in person in the end after several attempts to do so. But I tell you what, the reason that I'm excited about this one, I love doing shows that are outside of our normal working life and the field that we're in.
Absolutely. I do. The thing I love about this one is that I love developing creative methods to gather insight and conduct research. And our guest is all about that. So I'm particularly excited about that. And also because he comes from a very interesting career background. He's got a very interesting career background, so that's interesting.
True. And that's one of the things that I like about the show, actually. I know it's our show and everything, but it is one of the things I like.
I'm glad you like it.
I know. But people also say it to me, it's varied, and the thing I really like hearing about when we hear all these different stories is nobody's got a linear career. It just every person I speak to sort of confirms it. And before we move on to introducing Lee, let's just preface briefly the Christmas extravaganza, as we're calling it.
We're naming it.
We're going to call the Rory Sutherland is coming on for the December show, so we're calling it a Christmas extravaganza. Well, naming it or framing it, whichever way around.
Ooh.
Yeah, you see what
great
I did there?
Question.
Little bit of behavioral science in there. I'm just going to preface it now and say I don't think that show will end up being an hour. I've heard him on other shows. Our pre-show check-in was an hour anyway, and that was supposed to be 10 minutes. So it will be great, but it will probably run a little bit longer, maybe even release it in two shows. But keep an ear out for that one in December. That one will be great. But for now, let's stop talking about that. Future shows and get on with today's guest. Lee Caldwell is a cognitive economist and the founder of Irrational Agency, which is a behavioural market research agency based in London and Amsterdam. Lee designs research methods to close the gap between what people say they do and what they actually do, which is why he's a great guest for today's show. He builds on the discoveries of the scientific community in psychology and experimental economics and incorporates these into practical research methods that companies can use to understand the unconscious minds of their customers. He's also active in the academic research world, authoring papers and conference talks on how people learn, think and decide, including his proposed System 3 addition to the dual process model from Kahneman. He is the director of the Cognitive Economics Society, which organises conferences about the economics of the mind. He's also the author of The Psychology of Price, which is a book on behavioural economics and its application to pricing strategy. This uses the imagined case study of a chocolate teapot company to show businesses how to understand their customers' minds and use that knowledge to earn higher margins. So, without further ado, let's go over to the show.
Let's go.
We'll be right back. Okay, welcome to the show, Lee Caldwell.
Hi, great to meet you.
Hello.
Yeah, great to have you. Lee, why don't you start us off by talking to us about how you got to where you are today? Where did you start out?
Right. Well, I started out really as a mathematician. And so I guess it's a... that's a lens that I always bring to behavioural science and to all the work that I do. I studied maths and physics. I came out of university thinking, right, I'm going to develop some new mathematical theories to revolutionise the world of mathematics. And
shy and retiring, were you?
That was me, yeah. And I thought, so it was about 94, 95 when this happened. And I thought, oh, wait a minute. I'm going to stop this for a couple of years and make some money on the internet, because there were all these kind of billion-dollar internet startups, and I had done a bit of work on programming at university, and I thought, okay, I can get into this, and I will just do that for a while, and that will then fund all my exciting research activities that I'm going to do in later life. And so I got a bit distracted with that for 10 years or so, building internet technology, building websites and databases and all of the kind of fun things that people were doing in the dot-com boom. Mm-hmm. And I had a company that was doing that, and I got to a point where I realized that people weren't buying from my company as much as they should have been, in my humbled opinion. And I realized that I was making a lot of assumptions about how customers buy, about their logical decision-making processes, yeah, about the fact that if I was cheaper and I had better services, then people should always buy from me. And obviously, as every listener will recognize, there's assumptions of rationality built into that. So I kind of realized that that wasn't entirely working, and particularly actually around pricing. I had this question around how should things be priced? Is it just supply and demand, or is it something a bit more complicated? And there wasn't really a lot of good literature out there. So I sort of plunged myself into this area of psychology, looking at what I could find in the academic literature, going to conferences with psychologists and economists, and trying to explore, is there something I could learn about how people make decisions, how much money they want to spend, and could I then bring that back into my business and apply it? And I still had this mathematical mindset that I brought from my previous work about building models of how people think and how they behave, and understanding that quantitatively. So I found that there was this field just starting to become known called behavioral economics. This was probably 2006 or so. Mm-hmm. And there weren't really, you know, Nudge hadn't come out, Predictably Irrational hadn't come out, those books that have popularized the field were not there yet. But I was going to the seminar at UCL every week, and I was going to the Society for Judgment and Decision Making conference, and finding out, you know, what the lay of the land was, and learning directly from the academics who were doing this work. And so I then kind of moved into that field. I realized that the stuff I was learning about psychology and economics and behavior, I could not only use in my own business, but I could actually sell that expertise and start to be an interface really between the academic research that was going on and the practical application, because there were very few people in business then who knew about this stuff, who understood that there was even a field of human behavior and psychology. So I then did that for a couple of years. I wrote a book on pricing called The Psychology of Price, and adapting, you know, taking some of those behavioral economics lessons and showing companies how to use them. And then realized that actually there was a natural space within industry for this knowledge to surface, to be used, which was in the market research world. So there was a market research industry dedicated to asking people questions, understanding human behavior, but they were doing it in a very logical way. They kind of would do surveys, they would do focus groups, and they would say to people, you know, would you buy this product? Yeah. Yes or no? Yeah, and people would say yes or no, or they'd give us a response from 1 to 10, and then the researchers would write down the answer and put it in a chart and say, look, people are 8 out of 10 likely to buy this product, let's launch it. And about half the time that would work, and half the time it wouldn't work. So bringing behavioral science into that and closing the gap between what people claim to do or what they say they do and what they really do turned out to be an important contribution. And that's really where I've been doing for the last 10 years with Irrational Agency, is helping companies to understand what their consumers, how their consumers really behave, as opposed to how they say they behave.
I love the journey. And I was just thinking, because I've been talking a lot to people lately about the value of diversity. I was the guest on the show last month, which was really weird. And some of the stuff that we were talking about was about having done stuff in lots of different fields and that being a real value. It sounds like you had a similar type of journey of having been in lots of different places and being able to draw on those. But I want to just bring us back, actually, Lee, to the book, because obviously it's a big part of your sort of journey. Could you tell us a little bit more about the psychology of price? Like what is the stuff that you covered in it? I note that it's the example is this chocolate teapot company. So just explain to us a little bit more about that, please.
Yeah. So I wanted to bring together a couple of things. I wanted to bring some of the discoveries that had been made within the behavioral science space, and many of them listeners will be familiar, you know, things like anchoring, things like the Goldilocks effect or the decoy effect, and hyperbolic discounting, where if you pay for something in the future, it's less painful than paying for it today. So there are a lot of individual phenomena, each of which can be a useful tip or a useful tactic for people to use in their pricing. But I also wanted to bind it together in a way and not just have, you know, 10 separate tips. I wanted to first build, again, my mathematical mindset, build a model. So the book opens up with a look at value. What is it for people to value something? How much value do people get from the product they buy? And creating an approach for how you can quantify that, how you can see it in comparison to the other things they buy. It may be that when you buy your chocolate teapot, you compare it to other chocolate teapots on the shelf, but actually you might be more likely to compare it to buying a cup of tea in Starbucks or buying a bar of chocolate. And you know, there's bar of chocolate gives you an emotional benefit, a cup of tea gives you a different emotional payoff. It's not just about finding the cheapest option, it might be about creating the most value. So I wanted to tie everything together in a way that was quite applicable. People could actually follow these steps, apply it to whatever product or service they had, and then go out and find the right price. But I wanted to also keep people engaged in the book. There's a stat which is probably, you know, not literally true, but a stat that 90% of business books that are purchased don't get read beyond chapter one, because people kind of think of it probably is that, you know, you get the idea, you get the punchline of the book almost from the title, and then the first chapter is like, oh, let's get into this, and then people lose interest. So I wanted to make sure that it was a story to keep pulling people through, and so I tell the story through the book of this chocolate teapot company and how it's founded and how it grows and tries all these techniques, so people get to see almost a mini case study of each technique and approach that is being used throughout the book, and then get to see how it ends up. And this idea of creating a narrative has actually influenced some of my later work in my later research. The idea that stories and narratives are a way that we make decisions, that binds together the many of the facts that we know about the world. We use stories to link them together and make them meaningful to us. And that actually plays out a lot in, I think, how the human mind works.
That's a very interesting point. And when you were talking about the research methods, the more implicit side of things, is that something that you touch about? You touch on, you know, through the storytelling, through those stories. That's the sort of stuff that you were talking about in terms of going beyond the straight answer, straight question.
Very much so, yes. So if we are, for example, if we're interviewing somebody about a product that they might buy, or about the way that they engage with the way that they engage with TV channels or with medication or whatever we're talking to them about, we'll often ask them to tell us stories. And those stories can be about, tell me about the programs you used to watch as a kid with your parents or your grandparents. Or it can be, tell me about your dream holiday, and put it in a narrative form. So that both, it makes it more interesting for the respondent than just asking questions. It helps them open up, and once they start telling a story, they draw themselves in, and you can tell your own story back, you can play off it and get more depth. But it also reveals that the way people construct stories is out of causality. So cause and effect, A leads to B, B leads to C. There's a lot of theory around storytelling that explains that it's all about everything has to follow naturally, logically from the previous step. And when people tell you a story, they are revealing what they naturally think follows. A implies B, B implies C. They are telling you essentially their causal model of the world. They're telling you how they think the world works by telling a story about it. And if you analyze a story and look for those steps, where does A transition to B? Then you can find, well, this person believes that after A, B naturally comes next. And that actually is a really, really powerful insight. And we can do this, although I talk about doing it face-to-face, we also do it quantitatively. So you might have 1,000 people typing their stories in a survey, and we analyze those stories using natural language processing and so on to see what is people's mental model of how the world works.
This is so interesting, because we were talking about this literally this week in some of our co-production work. Yeah. Is, you know, yes, you can ask people questions, but we must get people to tell their stories for the exact reason that you just said, actually. And it reminds me of what you're talking about. There's a really great video where Trey Parker and Matt Stone, you know, the creators of South Park, talk about storytelling. Yep. And they have the button there for rule. So if there's any point in their story that they don't get to say at the end of the scene, but, or, therefore, it doesn't flow, it doesn't work. So exactly. Everything has to come to a problem statement. Da-da-da-da-da happened, but then this thing happened and that was the problem. Or this happened and therefore everybody did X. But then, you know, so it always has this but therefore thing, which I think is really, really key. And I think something that we really don't explore enough certainly, because obviously we're talking from a public health perspective. This is obviously the Behavioural Science and Public Health Network. But the reason that we ask people like you, Lee, to come on is because that diversity of experience and thinking is so valuable in helping contextualize what's working elsewhere and business and pricing. These are obviously, you know, really well-trodden paths, even if you're taking a slightly different approach to them, which sounds like you are. They're really sort of, you know, hardcore business priorities, pricing, getting the pricing right, making sure you're marketing effectively and stuff. So I think we've got a lot to learn from this type of thing. And I'm particularly interested in storytelling. You've got a big background in sort of different ways of collating information. Have you come across the storytelling?
Yes, I actually worked with written descriptions along those lines. So this is a very phenomenological, very philosophical, academic field. And I did stuff with Van Manen's theoretical stance around written descriptions, but it really aligns to what you're saying, which when you were explaining about written description, especially because you mentioned about, you know, building the bridge between academia and the real world, I was trying to formulate a question along the lines of how do you, especially if you're talking about research and consumer insights, how do you sell the narrative of, oh, we're not really just going to ask questions, we're going to ask people to tell us a story? So how do you sell that narrative and argument of, I'm just going to ask them to tell me a story?
Well, in some ways it automatically comes, because that's how we set ourselves apart from other research agencies. There's probably 1,000 research agencies out there, and most of them work by asking people questions. And so if we go in and say to a client, we're not going to do that, we're going to share some stories, we're going to infer from what they say instead of asking them directly, we automatically stand out. And if a client is not interested in that method, then the conversation won't go anywhere. But the ones that we are engaging with, that we keep talking to, are the ones who know that that's what they expect from us. And honestly, there's that old method of asking questions is kind of commoditized now. Everyone knows how to do it. You can go on a platform and set up your own survey and ask those questions yourself. So if somebody wants the added value of bringing in an agency to help them with their research, then usually they are looking for something different, and this is one of the things that is different.
Yeah, and I think Stu and I have lots of conversations about the importance of bringing creativity, especially in our field of work, public health, the importance of bringing those side narratives and the creative element into asking questions, into conducting research and insights projects. So I think that's fascinating stuff.
I think people know, researchers know that there is a gap between claimed and actual, and they are always open to some kind of new solution that might help close that gap. So we find that people do naturally understand the power of stories. You only have to tell a story to somebody in a meeting and they will immediately see the point. So we don't get too much resistance on that front.
The other thing is you can, all of the best, I always think to the 2005 commencement address at Stanford University with Steve Jobs. I'm a little bit obsessed with it. I'm not saying that he was a brilliant guy all the time. He wasn't. But that 2005 address at Stanford was incredible. And that was, and he literally starts by saying, I'm just going to tell you three stories. Nothing too big, you know, just three stories, simple. And they're all super engaging. I think people just, and it's not even just the fact that it's, you know, a technique to use. It's not something that we've had to develop over the years. Like that's been the way that we have transferred information for millennia. You know, before we could write, we were telling stories, and so it's so embedded in our psychology at a deep level that it makes complete sense. And I just don't think we're doing enough of it, particularly in, well, some people are. Some people are, you know, doing a great job of it. By the sounds of it, you're doing a great job of it, Lee. But I think, if you were speaking to some people in public health or in health and wellbeing generally, and I know that's not the area you work in, so this is why it's a really interesting question to ask you. What would you say to them about how to justify that approach instead of it being, you know, like there's a safety in saying, we asked people and they said this. There's a safety in that. But if you're inferring, there's a level of your interpretation in there that could be up for criticism. So how do you make it safe to do it in the same way?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think back to a client of mine who is a, well, I can say who they are because we've spoken about this with them publicly, UK TV. They're a TV channel, or they own several TV channels. They were spun out of the BBC. And they had been doing qualitative research for a while. They wanted to know, why are people not watching this channel, or why are more people not watching this particular TV channel? So they've been doing qual research for a while, and people were just giving them the same answers over and over again. And so we said, we're going to bring this methodology where we will gather thousands of people's stories, we will measure them and interpret them in this very specific way. So we kind of set out the model. And it was quantified. It was scientific because it was based on cognitive science specific theories that were underlay it. And their stakeholders really valued the fact that there was a science behind it. They said, well, one, it's quantified. Like the fact that you can quantify the stories people are telling, that's pretty powerful. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it is scientific, that you can show the outputs in this using these specific visualization tools, that was part of what sold it to them. It was not, it didn't feel like just listening to somebody and putting your own subjective view on it. There was a clear methodology of, this is how we're going to interpret the outputs. In fact, you mentioned that, therefore, we actually have an algorithm that looks for these connecting words, therefore, so, because, but. It looks for those words in the sentences and automatically pulls them out into a graph. And the fact that it had that rigor was absolutely an important part in that, with that client, of selling the technique. And I suspect with many public health practitioners, that would probably be the same. It's to say, you know, this is not just our opinion. It comes from somewhere.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I love this idea of looking for the connecting words, because that's where people feel causality and stuff exist. Yeah. If they're saying but and therefore and so,
exactly, yeah. And so we don't just do text processing. We also have word associations that we do. So we'll get someone to tell us a story, and then we will take them through a set of word associations. We'll throw up a grid of 25 words on screen, say which one do you associate with the story you've told us, and then the one they pick, we say, okay, which words do you associate with that? So then what's the, so you're kind of doing a series of word associations. You build up this tree or network of associations that are really revealing the kind of neural connectivity that people have between the concept of, say, TV and fun, the concept of fun and warmth, the concept of warmth and family. And so they might have this narrative of TV, fun, warmth, family that connects, that makes family an aspect of TV that's important to them. And they might not have said that if when you first asked them the story, but actually they reveal it by when you uncover these deeper connections.
Yeah, so interesting, isn't it? I mean, as we're recording this on the 25th of October, so we're obviously Christmas is already knocking on the door. There's stuff everywhere talking about Christmas. I have to say, I do love Christmas, and I'm now thinking as you're talking, Leah, whether I love Christmas as in part because of the sitting on and looking at the TV times, you know, in the beginning of December and circling what we're going to watch together and all that type of stuff.
That idea of anticipated pleasure. Is a really interesting one. There's lots of good behavioral science around that from Lowenstein, people like that, looking at do you in fact get as much pleasure from thinking about an experience in the lead up to it and then remembering it afterwards as you get in the actual moment of the experience. And so much of our life takes place within our minds. I mean, we think about economics as well, it's about material. It's about you trade things, you buy goods, and then you consume the goods, and that's where your utility comes from. But so much of our life, and you know, 90-something percent of our life, we're not actually consuming a thing. I mean, yes, I'm drinking my cup of ginger and lemon tea here, but by and large, we aren't consuming a product most of the time. We are, in our minds, we're processing the past consumption and imagining the future consumption. And this is where, so the field that I work in academically is called cognitive economics. And it's all about the idea that we're consuming mental objects rather than physical objects. And how do you model what those mental objects look like, how much they're worth, how you trade them with each other, how you build them or invest in them, you know, all of those economic concepts, but looking at thoughts and feelings and dreams and memories rather than cars and oil and houses and bananas.
And bringing us back a bit to your bread and butter of psychology of price, I think, because a lot of what we're talking about, even Stu's example of Christmas, that is intangible, that feeling that it just exists within ourselves. How do you actually go from asking people about that and talking about that and identifying those key concepts into placing a price to that experience?
Well, this is, being able to price the intangible is kind of a holy grail of pricing, because anything that's physical is commoditized. And your price for a barrel of oil or a banana is kind of driven down to the level of the cheapest that someone else will sell a banana for. And so you can't make any money on bananas. What you can make money on is the promise that your banana is organic, has this, you know, authentic sourcing, is more,
it's beyond the product, isn't it?
All of those things, all that, and again, story that you attach to the product will make it worth more. There's a great study researchers took a collection of random objects that were worth like a dollar each and wrote a story about each one and attached the story and then sold them on eBay. And they sold for, in many cases, dozens or hundreds of times more than the object, you know, a key ring or a piece of metal that would have just been a piece of metal. But then the story was that it was the nail from this ship that had sailed to these places and this is what happened to it. You know, you can debate the ethics of that experiment because the stories weren't necessarily true. But if you can come up with a story that is true about your product, then suddenly your nail becomes a carrier of a mysterious trip around the world instead of just a rusty piece of iron.
And funnily enough, you mentioned ethics. I was going to ask you about that. Where is the line between asking those things and really getting to what people want, not just what people say they want, and then pricing that and then sell that back? Where is that line?
In my view, the goal here and the key question is, are you giving people something that's genuinely valuable to them?
Yeah.
And if you're giving people the value of, I can experience Christmas in a new way, or every time I see this, I take this keyring out of my pocket, it brings back a memory of where it came from or the associations. All of that is genuinely worth something. If you are manipulating people by either, you know, telling them something that isn't true, or if you let's think of PPI as the you know, the PPI mis-selling scandal of several years ago. So somebody figured out that you could take advantage of people's cognitive biases, that they really wanted safety. They were worried about borrowing money, so the fact that they could insure the loan they'd taken out was very appealing. And the it was also a kind of an easy default, because people didn't understand what they were buying very well. It was very easy for them to just tick another box and say, fine, I'll buy this option as well. That's what's recommended after all. And the bank, surely the bank knows what they're doing, because they know more than me about this stuff. So all of those cognitive biases. Now, you could say that they were creating a little bit of value because they gave people a feeling of extra security and safety, but it was illusory. And it turned out if you know, you lost your job and you couldn't repay the loan, well, the insurance probably wasn't going to pay out. So actually, you were, you know, that I think nobody would debate really is unethical, albeit that you might have given people a little bit of emotional comfort along the way, but at the cost of the anguish and fraud almost when it went wrong in the end. So it's you know, it's easy to pick the worst examples, I guess. And I think it's a reasonable question to ask. And you know, the good test is, if someone wrote an article in the Guardian about what I'm doing, would I be happy or would I be annoyed? And so I think that's why you do need to think about what's the consumer genuinely getting out of these intangible benefits, and would the consumer themselves agree that those are worth something?
That's a difficult one, though, isn't it? Because
it is, yeah.
It's all subjective. So what one person thinks of as genuine value, another might think of as quite exploitative, especially in if it plays on their fears or whatever. That's a real conundrum, actually. I mean, authenticity to one person doesn't make it authentic to somebody else.
Yeah, and I think people, very difficult. Some people might say, well, I can put my own Christmas meaning onto this ornament. I don't need you to tell me the story. But is that entirely true? You know, we do take in the stories that people or companies give to us, and they do affect us, and we do incorporate them into our model of the world. So you might think, yes, I could have made that up myself, I didn't need you, but actually you didn't make it up yourself. And so there was an interesting question that came up recently. A lot of the work we've done in the last year has been around the FCA has this new regulation. So the FCA is the Financial Conduct Authority. They regulate banks and insurance companies and so on. And they have published a new set of rules that say, one, that customers have to get good positive outcomes from everything you buy, everything you sell them. And secondly, that you can't take advantage of their behavioral biases, even inadvertently. So, you know, an insurance company might have had a gold, silver, bronze option. More people buy the silver because that's the natural Goldilocks effect. But the insurance company now has to ask itself, is that actually the right thing for these consumers? Are they getting a better product from the silver? Is it more suited to their needs? And if not, then they might have to say, well, the gold, silver, bronze is misleading people into picking the wrong option, so we have to stop doing it. And question came up recently with an insurer where they said someone had insured their phone, and they lost their phone or it got stolen and they got a replacement, but they had previously a white iPhone and the replacement was black. And so the customer complained and said, this was not, you know, I didn't get a replacement for my phone, I wanted a white one. The company was able to go back to their terms and conditions and say, actually, this, you know, we don't promise a particular colour. That's, and it went up to the insurance ombudsman, and the company was found to be in the right technically, but they're now having to ask themselves under consumer duty, this new rule, did that customer get a good outcome? Even if the customer, even if we told them in advance, this is what you're going to get, and they signed the document, is that really what they expected? Were they able to really think through all of the consequences of their decision at the time of making it? Maybe not, because they're, you know, you sign an insurance contract, there's a thousand things that could happen. There's no way you're going to consciously go through all of them. And so sometimes you do have to make that judgment after the fact and say, what is the most fair and reasonable thing for the customer to have expected with hindsight?
That's an interesting development in that field, because that actually could have ramifications for lots of fields beyond that, actually, where the selling is more and more dubious, although it has been quite bad in FCA terms as well in the past. Mm-hmm. Lee, I want to take us to, I did think of an example, actually, of where, you know, you imbue meaning in something and overpay. You know, when you go to a gig and they're selling T-shirts at like 50 quid or something, and you think, well, I could buy that T-shirt for 20 quid online, but that's not the point. The point is, I bought it from here, it reminds me of that time I went to X, Y, or Z, you know, insert.
Yeah, it's like wine, isn't it? Wine is also a very common one.
Wine, that's an easy one.
Yeah, you know that this wine is, you know, from Bordeaux in this year and is fancy. Whether you are, you know, whether we have the taste buds to detect if the wine's better is a different question. But yeah, you know, I think that T-shirt is a good example. You know that this T-shirt was bought in that place. It wouldn't have the same meaning to you if you had bought it online. Now, there's definitely a series of things that can happen that can affect that. Like you get the T-shirt from someone else who was at the concert, and now you don't know for sure
if it was,
where they really got it. There's an episode of Seinfeld that I sometimes use where George buys John Voight's car. It's the car that the actor John Voight previously owned, and he buys this car, and then he's so happy with this car. He's you know, he paid over the odds for it, no doubt, because the dealer sold it to him in that way. But he's you know, he's telling everyone, it's like he feels like a king of the world driving this car down the streets of Manhattan. And then Jerry opens up the you know, the glove compartment and takes out the owner's manual, and sure enough, John Voight is written on there, but it's spelled wrong, and he's like, this is not the right John Voight. And George has just lost the thousands of dollars of value he was getting, and it's like, oh, did you really have to tell me? And you know, like the end of a film, I could save you a lot of time by telling you the end of a film you're going to watch. That's economically rational, but you kind of don't want to know. And this, there's another field called information avoidance that's related here, and people like David Hagman and Emily Ho working on that are looking at, do we sometimes, are we willing to pay not to have information? So that's another form of intangible benefit, is not knowing something.
Great. Let me move us on here. So one of the things that I'm keen to do is try and pose some very difficult questions to you. I like putting people on the spot.
Thank you.
Apt for the task.
This wasn't in the
script.
No, I didn't. I don't write it. Otherwise, people don't. No, people don't come on. Otherwise.
Okay.
But I mean, I'm really interested in, and I think our listeners will be really interested in this sort of these obvious corollaries between what you're describing and what they might be experiencing. Because our listeners are in public health, they're in industry, they're behavioural science students, they're behavioural science practitioners, etc. So how, you know, all the things that you talked about in terms of developing the offer, if you like, the package that goes around an offer, in fact, not just the offer itself. We're dealing with let's not go into too much detail, but in areas where people are making choices, and they're not choices between a category. So it's not saying, for example, I'm going to buy a car, or I'm going to buy a new lawnmower, and then they're getting into brand, and then they're getting into specs and things. This is like, you know, losing weight, stopping smoking, reducing their alcohol intake, getting vaccinated, these types of things. How would you approach those? Because you're from a sort of slightly different background, I think it's valuable to hear just on those sorts of topics of personal choice that's about it has got obvious benefits. Everybody understands the benefits. But then, you know, how do you actually package those things up and get people to choose them?
Yeah. I think there's a really, really good application of this work in that space. One of the big challenges in making good decisions is time horizon, is the conflict between what I get now and what I get in the long term. And that's, of course, really important in most of those public health topics that you've said. Do I get the joy, the pleasure of the cigarette now or the donut now, and in 10 or 30 years, I pay the cost? Now, this of course, is pervasive throughout human life. Almost everything that we do has got some kind of trade-off between now and later. And humans have only been able to get to where we are as a species by gaining the capability to prioritize later. So that could be about learning to store food for the winter and not eat it right away. It could be learning to build houses. That, you know, you build a house, it takes effort, it costs resources right now, but it will protect you in the long term. Ultimately, you know, we then built cities, we invested in infrastructure, all of these things that humans have done. And I believe the way that we gained the ability to do that, because not all organisms have that. You know, if you're an amoeba, you're just driven about by the chemical gradients in the sea. You can't think about anything outside of your immediate environment. And other animals can sometimes do it to a limited extent. You could say a squirrel buries acorns, although that's probably more instinctive than it is genuinely envisaging the future. But by and large, it's something humans can do better than pretty much any other animal. And I believe the way that we gained that capability is through the ability to imagine the future and to get an emotional payoff from what we imagine. So, and it's very much related to storytelling. So you can imagine, you can think of that amoeba, it knows that it acts as if there's more nutrients in to the right than the left. So it just follows the nutrients towards the right. Mm-hmm. It's not really imagining anything, it's just reacting to what's there right now. But if the amoeba could imagine that actually 6 inches in the other direction, there's an even better, richer place to go, and it could motivate itself to go in that direction, it would do better. It would basically be a more successful organism. And essentially by what I'm doing by, say, not having a cigarette now, is that I am imagining the future that I'll be in 30 years' time. I am thinking about, probably imagining two versions of that future, one where I'm healthy and I'm fit, and another where maybe I have lung cancer. And I'm projecting myself into those two states and feeling the feelings that I would have. And I, you know, obviously I don't know what it feels like to have lung cancer, but I imagine it's pretty bad. I can think, what's it feel like to be healthy? So I've got two imaginary future versions of myself. And each of them has its own emotions, its own reward level. And I know which one is more rewarding. And so I pull that reward back into the present moment. And I'm able to say, by not having the cigarette, I will experience a little bit of that expected reward 30 years from now, but I'll experience it right now. So you're kind of doing a little bit of time travel. You're taking the future rewards or the future positive emotion and vicariously experiencing it right now. And that ability to mentally simulate, not just to predict what will happen, but to actually feel the good or bad feelings that I will have, that is actually how we translate future states into present motivation. And that's what I call this mental simulation capability, sometimes system 3, because I think we all hear, you know, we know the system 1 and system 2 distinction. But I think that neither system 1 or 2 captures the ability to both project hypothetical situations, but then still feel them and experience them as if they were real, and get that reward or pain from that. And I think that that type of thinking is really how we are successful as human beings in the long term. And if we could take some of that into public health and say, okay, here is what you will, maybe just, I suppose, help people to do better future projections. Here is how you will feel if you have that cigarette now. Here's how you will feel in 30 years. And help them by maybe by storytelling, help them to get a more immediate sense of what that future will look like. Some people are better than others at doing that future thinking. It's a known kind of individual personality difference as to how short-term or long-term someone is, but everyone can do it better in some situations than others, so that we can help them.
I find that point about system three quite interesting, because even this morning I was working on a smoking cessation intervention, and a lot of what we were talking about is, which we experience in public health a lot, is just tell people what's going to happen if they do that, and then they certainly won't. And a lot of times that doesn't work. And I think, like you said, is finding the ability to attach the experience to the behavior and project them to the future. I like that you described it as almost like time travel. So I think going back to what we were talking about in terms of what public health can learn from marketing and economics and behavior science in general, I think it's the ability of thinking beyond assuming that people are that rational. If you tell them it's going to be bad, then they won't do it. So it's thinking outside the box. And I do like the expression of the time travel, because that's what needs to be done with a lot of these health behaviors, especially the ones that lead to poor outcomes, I think.
Yeah.
See, I can see that, right, with the choosing to change. Definitely. My broader question, because I have a theory that would compete with system three, maybe, or maybe it wouldn't. Nice. Maybe it would be incorporated into it, but the habit before the habit is what we use in our services,
right?
And that's actually about doing things immediately when you're thinking in system three forward planning thing. You're going, well, that's what I want to achieve. I ask, what could you do right now to kick off that habit chain? Well, what could you do? Literally get your phone out, do this, buy that, do it now, and the chain is sort of on its way then, right? And there's going to be things that get in the way, fine, but at least you've done something, you're on the road. It's not just relying on you to do something in the future. But my and smoking's a great example, because smoking has a deeply physiological sort of need for the nicotine addiction or whatever. Smoking could be one where that would be very difficult, because moment to moment you're having to resist, you're having to say no to yourself moment to moment. So that strength and the vividness with which you are sort of envisaging the future would have to be extreme, I think, to be able to sort of stop you from smoking. I think you need other things, and obviously we know that, because we've got, you know, stop smoking aids, etc. Or transitioning to vaping, for example, or whatever, so you replacement. But something like food and weight loss, and then vaccination, similarly, you if you have that vivid sort of future imagining, and COVID was a great example of people having a very serious choice to make, for example, but it's a one-off, it's a one-off thing. Losing weight, for example, reducing alcohol, these are things that are constantly needing to be chosen.
Yeah.
So
yes, let me say something about that. And I think it does apply a little bit to cigarettes, but it's probably as a harder task. So some of this work, there's some of this idea about cognitive economics comes from the work of George Ainslie. He wrote a book called Pico Economics, and he works on addiction. So he has been for many years looking at models of how people become addicted, what are the mechanisms that essentially mediate between this the short-term reward that you get from engaging in the immediate action versus the potential long-term reward you get from not engaging. And one of the things that I think system three can do is it can actually train us. It can train system one in a way, because really I think what you're saying is you want a system one behavior to intervene that will either stop you picking up the cigarette, stop you eating the food or drinking the alcohol. And system one can either be trained by experience. So if we Pavlovian, you know, you go and you eat the thing or hear the bell or whatever, then you train yourself by direct experience. But I think that by repeatedly thinking about something enough times, if you're getting that vicarious synthetic reward by thinking, by imagining the good outcome, then eventually it will become automatic, and that you will get that reward immediately from the thing that you've started to associate with that long-term benefit. I'm not saying that it's, you know, it it might be difficult for that to build up enough to outweigh the immediate hit of nicotine, for example, because that is so powerful. But I do think that you can, and people do retrain their minds to get reward from different things. It can go, you know, in the case of eating, it can go wrong, can cause eating disorders. If you train yourself that food is disgusting or food is problematic or food is going to make you a bad person, then that can go the other way, and your mind can then end up reacting in a very unhealthy way to food. But that's, in a way, it's kind of, although that's a pathological version of it, it does kind of demonstrate that it can work. You can relearn, you can rewire some of the neural reactions to those immediate stimuli. And I think the way you, well, one of the ways that you do that is through imagination and then repeatedly associating the imaginative outcome with the immediate behavior that you're considering.
Interesting. So it's like there's, it seems to me like there's more of a long-term, so that there's a transition that's required from being able to get dopamine from that constant envisioning process over time. But initially you'd probably need a decent chunk of willpower to continually press against that, maybe.
Yeah, probably. And maybe there are, maybe you put yourself in a situation where you can't get access to the donut for a while, and then you only have the imagined donut or the imagined health outcome to play with, and so that might give you the space to reprogram yourself in that way.
So you could apply some combi in all of that in terms of like restructuring the environment and whatever. Okay, right. Well, Lee, we are coming to the end of our show, and we have a couple of questions left. One of them is, if you were advising people with an interest in behavioral economics, behavioral science, thinking about getting into the field, what would your advice to them be? How could they get started, or how could they, if they're already working, get sort of involved in it?
Well, I think there are quite a lot of different networks and groups that you can go into and talk to people. We run something called the London Behavioural Economics Network, which has been a little bit in abeyance during the lockdown, but we're getting it restarted again. That was, and hopefully will be again, a monthly meetup where people can come if you happen to be in London. There are some other groups around the world that are similar, so you can go and meet people in the field. I would definitely, you know, the pop science books, albeit that one or two of them have started to get a not as good a reputation recently for reasons, but there are still a lot of good pop behavioral science books that are that will give you a genuinely valuable introduction to the field. Not particularly suggesting mine because it is quite specialist, but books like there's actually a nice book called Irrationality by Stuart Sutherland, if you can get hold of it, or Basic Instinct by Pete Lunn. I think those are both out of print, unfortunately, but you know, Predictably Irrational is still a good book, despite what might be happening that I really know. I'm just looking at my shelf. The Behavior Business by Richard Chataway is good. The you know, there are lots of books, and honestly, I'm a book person, so I learn in that way. But I think probably you'll also find good, there's some communities on Discord and Slack that are open to people that you can go and chat. If you're so minded, I mean, do go, and there are some very good master's courses out there. A lot of people that I know have come in to the field by taking a master's in behavioral science at somewhere, whether UCL or Warwick or Amsterdam. There's a number of different good places, and it can be, if you're at a point in your career where you want to try something different, then taking a year to do that, if you can take a year to do that, is very, very rewarding, and it gives you also the qualification to be able to go into a job in the field, which doesn't do any harm.
And I think in line of what we've
had many...
Sorry, Stu.
Oh, sorry. We have a rule that we put our hand up if we're going to come in. I just completely ignored Tiago's rule.
That's absolutely fine. I was just going to say, to add to Lee's answer, I think in line of what we've been talking about, just ask people stories and ask them to tell you their stories, where they are, if they work in a field, the sort of things, their career, the people they work with, the projects they work with. So I think storytelling is also important in that sense.
It's what people do when they come on the show, to be honest. True. That's what we ask. So inadvertently, I mean, we did do this on purpose. I would like to think that we base our show on various shows that we've liked in the past. The Life Scientific by Jim Al-Khalili is one of them. And I actually listened, I'm doing a binge at the moment, and I listened to Mary Johnston was on his show. It's nice to see him following in our footsteps, Tiago. That's what I'm saying.
Legacy.
Nice to see the BBC. Exactly. Yeah. But Lee, it's great to talk to you about this. I think people find this type of thing interesting because it's
absolutely
not the everyday world that they're part of in the public health sort of space that we're in. By the way, the other thing you can do as well is join the BSPHN. That's another thing, because you can get to meet a lot of people
through
that.
That was very smooth.
Well, you know me, I'm quite smooth at this. I'm quite good at the old podcast thing now. I think it's obvious. Lee, just quickly though, you mentioned the London Behavioural Economics Group that you mentioned?
London Behavioural Economics Network. It's also known as Boozonomics. Generally takes place in a pub. So it's nice to lower the barriers, lower the intellectual
resistance. It's all about the experience, isn't it? It's not the product.
Exactly.
It's all about the stories that come out of it. And so do you want to just, if people did want to go along to one of those, how would they do that? When is it? How are they?
So we are hoping to get that going from, I don't think it'll be November, but maybe from December or January. And so if you search for either Boozonomics or London Behavioural Economics Network on Meetup, then there's a Meetup group you can sign up to and join there. If you feel free to connect with me or follow me on LinkedIn or Twitter as Lee Blue, L-E-I-G-H Blue, and I will put the announcements on there as well. So you'll be able to.
And is that open to everyone with interest in?
It is, yeah. Just turn up and we generally get anywhere between 40 and 60 people at each event, and they're working across consulting, marketing, practitioner, civil service, some academics. I imagine that some of your listeners will already have been along, because there's definitely a public health kind of strand that shows up every so often there.
Well, having worked with the civil service in public health, I'm sure they would have. If it's called Boozonomics, definitely sort of frequented it from time to time. But you've answered our second question actually there, which is about how people get hold of you if they need to get hold of you. Is there any other ways that people can get hold of you?
Obviously our website, irrationalagency.com, you can feel free to put my email address onto the show notes if you like, if people are interested. I'd love to. We do, although public health is not a kind of major, it's not like the biggest part of our business, we do work within in healthcare, and we have some clients who are in pharmaceuticals or in the health space. So they're absolutely would be relevance to some of your audience there. So I hope to hear from some of you.
Yeah, fantastic. Great. Thank you, Lee. Thanks very much for your time today, Lee. It's been really fascinating talking to you. Do go out and check out Lee's book, available in all good bookstores.
You probably have to order it online, to be honest, but you might still find it in water stores.
But thank you very much, Lee. It's been great talking to you, and we'll let you get back to the rest of your day.
Fantastic. Thanks, Lee.
Thanks a lot. Great to see you both. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was fun, wasn't it, Stu?
It was great fun. Yes,
that was fun.
It was really good.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this one. I do enjoy all episodes equally, and I must say that all guests, I enjoy the conversation with them equally.
A disclaimer,
it's the script you sent me.
Well, what about the last one? I think you enjoyed more.
Equally, all of them.
Great guest.
I must say though, I do have a soft spot for people for talking to people who work with behaviour science but outside the public health realm.
Me too.
So I really like that side of things. So I just want to say a big thank you to Lee for sharing very interesting insights into the work that he does, and for handling Stu's difficult questions, because you put him on the spot a few times, I think.
That's exactly what this show is all about.
That's true.
Putting him on the spot, making him squirm. I think he did a great job though. He took it in his stride, and again, I just find it interesting when people outside of our regular sort of industry, in the public health industry, for example, talk about what they do and how they do it, because the whole point of diversity is not is to look at what works elsewhere and think how what are the things that are working, why exactly. is that working, and how could it apply better in our industry. So yeah, I think Lee
talked about the concept of storytelling, and that's something that I really like. Storytelling as a research method, I've worked with that in the past in academia, using storytelling and written description, even photography and drawings, and I really like using those creative methods to understand the things that people care about and their lived experience, especially in ill health, but even beyond that. So I really like to see different fields approaching storytelling and creative methods to research. So that was probably my favorite part of the episode, I would say.
Have you seen these PIP decks?
PIP decks.
I've been served a lot. I must have watched some of the adverts for them on social media or something, because I've been served a lot of adverts for these storytelling PIP deck cards where you pull out different cards and then it tells you how to structure a story.
Yes.
I feel like social media is telling me something, and that is you need to buy this. So maybe I'll do that
listening.
And see where we
they
end
are
up with the storytelling. The only other thing that I thought was interesting, well, not the only other thing, one of the other things I thought was really interesting that he was talking about was System 3. Obviously he's got his own theory about that. It ties into a lot of the habit before the habit stuff that we talk about and how to help people make behavioural changes. I think it's linked to that sort of identity piece as much as anything else. But yeah, it's certainly an interesting concept and something to look out for in his book. So if you are interested in that and you enjoyed hearing Lee speak, please go and check out The Psychology of Price. It's a really good book and well worth reading.
Yes. So Stu, who do we have next?
You know the answer to this.
Do I?
Yes.
It's Rory Sutherland.
We've been talking about it for about four months because we keep thinking it's next month.
We have. Rory Sutherland next. The Christmas extravaganza, Stu has named
it. Extravaganza, yes. It begins in December. So I am predicting, and since I do the editing, it probably will end up this way, but I'm predicting that the content will be so numerate that we need to sort of split it in two. However, let's see if we can keep it inside an hour. You know, that's the idea. That's what we're trying to do. But we're really excited. We're really excited to have Rory on. I've wanted him on the show for a long time. I love Nudge Doc, love Rory's books and talks. So I think it'll be a really great one for a Christmas extravaganza. Easy for me to say. In the meantime, I would just say thank you, Tiago, for another great show. Thank you to Lee. Look forward to Rory. In the meantime, take care of yourselves and take care of each other, and we'll see you in December.
All right, see you soon.
And therefore, any singing from now on in
will
be recorded, and probably will make it into the show at some point.
Did you speak to your lawyer to put that in the show in case I complain about the fact that you
don't need
adding
to?
Okay.
I've just told you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. If I sing, then
that's your warning.
Thank you.
The thing is, you always forget that warning.
I do, but I've got a post-it note in front of me, Stu, saying, don't sing.
Oh, dear. Okay, right.
Extreme measures. It requires extreme measures.
Let's get into it.